Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-hosts Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff.
Heyo.
Hey, you guys. Aaron, who's on the program this week?
I just got off this call literally like 45 seconds ago.
It's fresh, man.
It's fresh in my mind. I talked to Zach Harris. So sadly, there aren't as many features as there were when we started the show, but there's still some. And I read one and I was just like, this is great. I should just have this person on. I don't know anything about them. It was Zach Harris. He wrote this Rolling Stone feature about this bowler who, few things about him. He bowls two-handed. He's an insurgent on the tour who could become the greatest bowler of all time. And unlike a lot of people on the PABA tour, he's not like the son of a famous bowler. He grew up in like pretty rough circumstances in Texas and basically was like abandoned to the bowling alley as a child, as a form of like childcare. He's a really interesting character for a story and really kind of put me in a world in a way where I was like, I didn't know anything about bowling or Vegas or tournaments or anything. And it really stuck with me. So I wanted to talk to him about that. He covers weed, he covers skateboarding, and now he's covering bowling. So really fun conversation, Zach Harris.
The big beats, the Aaron Lammer beats.
You can see how I ended up doing this interview and enjoying it a lot.
It sounds like a little bit of like a throwback episode, and it reminds me of a throwback article that Michael Mooney article in D Magazine. You guys remember that? It's like, I think it's called The Most Amazing Bowling Story Ever or something like that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. The Bowling Magazine feature. Does it ever miss?
There could be no sport that I feel like has a higher hit rate than bowling. Of if you felt like you needed to write a feature story about this, I want to read that feature story.
Exactly. If it hit the bar, it's worth reading.
I was just thinking if I should try and brainstorm more, because if I say them, then they'll appear in the show notes and people can read them. But we'll try and find the long form bowling tag archive and link to that. There's got to be at least one other classic in there.
We make this show with the fine people at Vox. Thanks very much to them.
And now here's Aaron with Zach Harris.
Welcome, Zach Harris.
Hey, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
I'd love to talk about bowling with you a little bit. I guess I could start with, what is like your personal relationship to bowling? Like, where are you on the bowling spectrum?
I am in bowling, they call it a house hack. I bowl three leagues right now. I bowl a lot. It's a lot of bowling.
A lot of bowling. Okay.
But I kind of look at it in the same way that, you know, 30-year-olds play golf or tennis, right, in the same, right, way where you're like, oh yeah, now I have a little bit money to like buy the gear that I want. I have a little bit of time and energy to like go do the things. And I have some friends around me who are also in the same place in life looking for something fun to do. And I'd always bowled as a kid. I mean, I always say that starting in, I believe it was middle school, but all the way through high school, they would, on the last week of school, give out little keychains that said, say no to drugs, say yes to bowling. That gave you two free games and a free shoe rental every day at the local bowling alley because they needed to stay in business, and kids bought hot dogs and extra games and went to the arcade. And so me and my brother would wake up every morning and not really say no to drugs, but we would say yes to bowling, and we would drive over to the bowling alley and bowl two games every single day all summer long. And so it was kind of, you know, fun. I liked doing it, but I didn't really get into it or buy my own equipment until my late 20s, early 30s.
I'm going to hit you with some naive questions here.
We love it.
Like, when you look at a pro bowler and like yourself, or let's even say like the aces in your league, like how much divide is there? You know, everyone's like doing the same thing. I see amateurs throw some pretty good games.
You, you do.
Guys rolling in the 200s. How far?
I bowled a 277 last night.
Wow.
And I would never, ever, ever dare dream of entering a tournament against guys like Simonson or the guys who I was talking to of this article.
Okay.
No, I mean, so the difference when it comes to, I mean, it was a line that got cut from the article, but that gap is Grand Canyon wide between like your average best bowler in your house and the guys who are actually out on tour winning money at the PBA. I think that was actually something with this article. There was a draft that was about double in length that went into very detailed depth about pro bowling and the modern bowling game and how league bowling interacts with pro bowling. So the whole thing with bowling is it is based on invisible oil patterns that you cannot see. And so we all know that there's oil on the lane. You don't want to step on the lane and slip. But the way they lay the oil out completely changes how the ball moves. And so that's why you have so many different bowling balls. And that's why you have so many different bowling styles, because you're always trying to find a way to combat the oil that you can't see. And so like guys like Simonson, who it feels like can see the oil that you cannot see, have another superpower for being able to play these lanes in ways that like I simply cannot, because it is not something I know how to do in the same way.
It was a fascinating detail, and I had never considered that like, these pro games are played in the same alleys. It's like, you know, it would be like if Steph Curry showed up at your LA Fitness for the NBA finals. Like, right. There's no difference between a pro and an amateur lane. And so pros have to learn to navigate pretty subpar equipment.
Yeah, that is true. And that's even before you get to, like I was saying, the different lane patterns where at league where I bowl, the oil pattern is built to be easy. And where they're bowling, it is built to be incredibly difficult. And if you miss by an inch, your ball is going to jump over to the gutter or it's not going to hook at all. Whereas the way they lay the oil out for us house hacks and everyone else who bowls league on Tuesday across the country, it's made to kind of funnel it right into the pocket to give those big scores like I scored last night. But yes, also, there are no major league bowling stadiums. So it makes it a lot harder for these guys to know what the conditions will be on every house. And I mean, there are a lot of guys, Simonson included, and just tons of guys on tour who are literal bowling alley encyclopedias. And if you talk about the high number side of the house in Kokomo, at the bowling center in Kokomo that they've bowled four PBA tournaments on in the last 5 years, they know that lane 15 hooks a little bit more than lane 16. And that if you're going down to lane one, you better move a little bit right because it's not going to hook at all or whatever. You know what I mean? And they've all got these notes and encyclopedic memories of bowling centers. It's very goofy in like the most endearing way possible.
So if you can bowl a 277, which is still kind of blowing my mind, the reason that you would never feel like you were anywhere near the competitive level, like a pro level, is a sense of consistency. It's like how often you can throw a 277.
Well, and on different conditions. It's all about the conditions. And so my 277 was thrown on a 8-foot hoop, if you want to do basketball, or a mini golf range. Okay. If we're talking, I mean, you know, maybe not a mini golf range, but like your easiest muni hole where you can hit the green if you strike a good drive or whatever, you know. Golfers and bowling, they very similar. Bowlers love to use golf analogies.
I mean, this is kind of a good introduction to stuff you write about in general. So you also write about skateboarding, you write about weed, and it feels like you really, really like want to write about things you know a lot about. Like, you know more about bowling than anyone I've ever talked to. And a lot of that knowledge, actually, as you said, isn't in the article, but it's like it has the feeling of people are willing to talk to you at a high level because you're like deep in that world. You could not have gotten to that level of bowling knowledge in the like week prepping for the story.
Well, and I never would have been able to pitch the story if I didn't know bowling. And that's, I guess, where I've come from as not ever been on staff at a magazine. I've been, you know, on staff places where I'm writing aggregated news throughout the mid 2010s. And then if it was like, if I wanted to write something fun or different or a feature or profile, I had to actually pitch it and think of something that not only appealed to me, but would appeal to a wider audience. And so finding the parts of the things that I'm interested in that might appeal to a wider audience, I think has always been, I guess, my only avenue to get published in Rolling Stone or as longer features or profiles that aren't just the simple, newsy, aggregated kind of bullshit that internet writing has become.
So, I mean, thinking about this as kind of like a practical show for people who want to do this kind of stuff, like when you're pitching something like this bowling story to an editor who may have like only birthday party experience at the lane, what is your sort of like strategy for communicating like, no, actually, this guy is like a big deal. Like, this is like the Patrick Mahomes of bowling this generation.
I mean, so Simonson, this one, this piece was 6,000 words, but then you got to fit into a magazine. And so then it goes down to 3,000 words. And
Hey, look, if you want to post the full version, we'll link to it in the show notes.
Never. I think the edits were very good. And I think it was well done. And I don't think people really want that much inside baseball about bowling. And I think that was funny because I thought that people might. And then when you got down to it, it's like, oh, no, this is just a regular sports story about a sports superstar in the way that you would a Patrick Mahomes or anything else. And so I thought it was really fun that the editors focused that way as opposed to trying to make it seem like bowling was something you needed to learn about. They kind of approached it as, well, people know what bowling is. We'll just tell this guy's story. But I approached it in my pitch as, so I guess I don't know how much you know about Detroit rap music, but
I've listened to a little I Swear Vezo, but
Yeah. So you will know well that the Cartier Buffs sunglasses, the Buffalo Horn sunglasses from Cartier, are very big in Detroit rap music. And Anthony Simonson has a bunch of friends out in Detroit. And during the Masters last year, which was held right outside of Detroit, one of the larger, though five major tournaments in the PBA season, he was leading the whole way, only had to win one game in the final TV show to take home the whole thing. And he did. And as soon as he won it on live TV, his group of buddies sitting just off camera presented him a pair of Cartier Buff sunglasses. And he like did a gladiator, hold his hands up kind of celebration on live TV. And I, as a bowling PBA fan, was like, who's this guy? And you do a little more research, and there had been things written about his tough family life before. There was a small documentary that Bowling Publication did about his tough childhood that like kind of touched on the surface of things, but was really well done. And so connecting his kind of pop culture status with like, you know, this kid's 26 and has won more than anyone else in an American pro sports league. And he's doing cool things like connecting to the Detroit rap scene. And he came up in a way that most sports superstars don't these days because they've got coaches since they were 13 and have been specialized by their helicopter parents. And he kind of came from a hard scrabble life and didn't really have support from his parents and just kind of figured it out on his own, but was the best in the world by 25. And so presenting it, like I said, kind of just like a more traditional sports story with those Detroit pop culture music connections for Rolling Stone. And I don't know, I'm lucky because I've known a lot of editors through skateboarding. And so Jeff at Rolling Stone, I've known through skate Twitter and skateboarding milieu. We've written for Vice about skateboarding in the past and, like, you know, been around the same circles of skateboarding. And so it felt reasonable to be like, hey, you heard about this bowling stuff? And to my surprise, they were like, yeah, let's do it.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Thinking about some of the stuff about Simonson's childhood that's in the article, there's a kind of like a sports cliche that you see out there. I feel like I identify it a lot with like the NFL draft, where you just kind of see like all the like terrible shit that happened to people before they got drafted. I mean, it's like a lot of really, really tough stuff, but it's often sort of presented as like he overcame this to like become like a successful champion. And in some ways, I think this piece really describes Simonson's childhood, not as like something he like overcame, but like, you know, it's sort of what like made him, like the 10,000, probably 100,000 hours at the lane as a child, because he, you know, his parents were working and couldn't really take care of him. It's like, hey, kind of makes sense that that guy is the Patrick Mahomes. He put in more out, like no normal child could have bowled this much.
Well, and as part of my pitch, that was, I mean, from the outside looking in at the PBA, there are a bunch of family names that have kind of carried through the PBA for generations. And so my kind of part of the pitch was, well, it seems like there's a little family legacy, and this kid Simonson didn't have that and came out of nowhere to compete with all these guys who we know their dad's name and we've seen their whatever, the whole legacy. And he was like, when I brought that up to him, I was like, no, I spent just as much time as their kids in a bowling alley that they ever could have. It had nothing to do with that. Like, it's about time and access to a bowling alley. And he had that just as much as anyone, even though his parents weren't around to actually coach him with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a quality about writing about class in America where it's like, almost we can only write about class like on like he's like a nepo baby, or he had like the most impoverished childhood possible. And there's a whole spectrum of American class that is not exactly either of those things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think he definitely fits into that, even though he may be way further on the dirt poor, you know, whatever, hard scrabble lifestyle thing. But he still loved his parents, and he still saw his parents all the time. And he's still like, yeah, his brother was going through addiction, but he was there for his brother. And like all these things where it's like, yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. I don't know. There's so many levels to it.
When you're in person doing like a story like this, so you're like, you fly to Vegas, you're hanging. Like, how are you behaving while you're
hanging? I'm good at hanging out. That's like my strong suit in life is hanging out. And so it was hard with him because at like, you know, from the time I touched down, I mean, so going back, he was very hard to get a hold of, which was didn't make sense to me because he is a professional bowler. And I'm like, do you want to be featured in Rolling Stone? And he just wasn't texting me back. And like I had gotten to his number through his like the guy at his brand, and I had talked to a couple of the other biggest pro bowlers in the country, and they were like, you know, I'll talk on background stuff about bowling, but I don't want to talk about Anthony until he's agreed to do the story. And I was like, yeah, sounds good, no problem, we'll reconnect later after this, but like also next time you see him, like tell him to hit me up. And I did that maybe three times and he still didn't respond to any of my texts. And then it was right after the season ended, he started responding, was like, oh yeah, sure, no problem. And it was just like a full disconnect between when the PBA season was going on and afterwards. And he was just like, okay, now my mind is clear from these things. Sure, no problem. But even landing in Vegas, he's a pretty spotty texter. So I was like, sure hope I can get in contact and get next to him sometime in the next 4 days. But as soon as I landed, he was like, yo, where are you? Like, let's hang out. And so, yeah, I feel like the idea that you can just hang out, and I set aside time for some interviews, and that was kind of the hardest to like get him to sit down and go through the hard stuff of childhood and like really do like sit down recorded interviews. I think we did 2-3 hours at a time, right? 2 hours at a time. So we did really sit down and go into stuff, but he was great. And so for the 4 days that I was there, I was pretty much just hanging out with him, him and his girlfriend, him and his buddies the whole time I was there. And like I said, I'm pretty good at hanging out. So whether it's just bowling or hanging out at his buddy's house watching UFC, I can get along. But I try not to do too much while hanging out because I knew I had the interviews planned. And so I'd be asking questions and I generally had the recorder on and told him as much. But I was focused on the interviews as the recording and just kind of letting the hanging out happen.
Yeah, I feel like in general, people I know who are good hangs, who are good at hanging out, are kind of like good at being in the moment and not like trying to get too much out of the moment. Is it difficult for you to like remember those moments when you go back to it? Like, does the act of like actually being good at hanging kind of like mean the recorder isn't running all the time?
I was really good this time and made sure the recorder was running all the time and kind of told him that as soon as we met up. I was like, I'm just always going to have the recorder on if that's cool with you. And he was like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah. And so I would just mark different times of the day in different places. So it was a little easier to go back to, because at least, you know, if you remember one conversation, it was either in the car, it was at his house, or it was at the restaurant. And so if you market that, it's a little easier to refresh. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there were things that happened that I did not include because it was just hanging out and it wasn't. But again, I already had too much. And so it was at this point, it was trying to figure out how to fit it all into a story that could publish in a magazine.
When you're like writing about bowling or like skating, like I think of these things as almost like sort of semi like instinctual. Like there's not like, well, what do you do on like 4th and 2 in bowling? It's like you're throwing, you're doing kind of a repetitive action. Mm-hmm. Like, do you ask someone to intellectualize what they're thinking and what they're doing on the court? Or is that unimportant to understanding the sport?
That's a good question. Intellectualizing sports is always fun just because I'm a fan of sports. And like, I mean, Simonson is, his whole life is bowling. Like the way his head works is bowling. And so he just can't help it.
Yeah.
And so then I just get super interested because I love bowling. And so then I just keep on asking questions. But I feel like my questions are less about that. Yeah. Especially with things like skateboarding or weed or wherever, where it's like, I don't really care about your growing techniques. I care more about the other stuff going on. And skateboarding, it's difficult because there is no correct way. You know what I mean? There is no, like you said, there's no 4th and 2 at all. Bowling, at least, it's like a structured sport.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with sports like skateboarding, and I think this would also apply to like, I don't know, surfing and certain other components, where it's like, it's more of a culture truly than an athletic competition. And it's had this athletic competition sort of stapled onto itself as a way to market and hierarchicalize.
Yes.
I don't know if that's actually a word, what people were already doing, but it can't be covered in exactly the same way as like the NFL, which is like, yeah, of course football is a competition. It's got like a scoreboard and there's like yard marks. How do you think about that? Like how do you, in writing about skateboarding, like is competition something that like interests you?
No. I mean, I guess in that it plays into how the larger culture sees it more. And so that's interesting to me. But I think it's fun coming at these things that people in the larger culture don't really know about or understand, as opposed to writing a profile of someone like Patrick Mahomes, who everyone already knows about. And everyone's just looking for a new quote that they can republish or a new thing that he said about the Packers or whatever. Whereas it's like, someone like a pro skateboarder or a pro bowler, you guys have never heard of. And so being able to present a person and a culture and a world to a wider audience, I think suits me well and has been really like a fun way to do profiles. And I'm not sure, like, again, like I said, the way that I've had my career and been able to pitch people, I can't pitch someone a profile of Patrick Mahomes because I'm not like a staff writer who has that kind of status and access. But if I come up with something fun that you've never heard of that might connect to the larger culture, then it kind of hits a nerve and a sweet spot for me. And so I think speaking to it on a cultural level as opposed to a granular sports level makes sense to people, as opposed to like you talking about skateboard competition and the numbers, like that doesn't make sense to people. It doesn't make sense to me.
As you've like sort of branched out of these subcultures and tried to write about them for a lay audience, what have you learned about like how to catch someone up on the subculture and what details are important versus like confusing? Like I'll admit, like every time like there's like the Thrasher skater of the year and people are arguing about it, I'm like, I need more context here. Like I would actually like to kind of understand it, but I don't know what I'm trying to understand.
Either. But that's the fun part is you don't get to understand because you're not in it. And that's, I guess, speaking to lay people from inside, that's so much of it. It's like you get a little taste. If you want to see more, you better start watching YouTube videos of pro skaters, or you better start going to the bowling alley more and figure out how to spin the ball or whatever. You know what I mean? And hopefully what I can give you is something that sticks with you enough that you want to go do that more and that that is something interesting to you. But I think it's incredibly hard to describe why the Thrasher Skater of the Year contest is so enthralling to people who skateboard. Because to most lay people, if you watch the videos back to back to back of the three top candidates, they look pretty much the same if you don't know what you're looking at. And so, yeah, I can imagine that is pretty difficult. But I think there's been some great writing in the past 5-6 years doing the same kind of thing. And I think people are seeing it more as just a influencer, person, cultural figure than sports star in the numbers way.
What, like, what's the state of skate media and like kind of in a larger sense, like subculture media right now? Like in some ways you would think that this would be a good time to be publishing in a niche because you can sort of reach the limited but like all over the world audience that's interested in it. But like at the same time, most of that sort of era of like, I guess, kind of like verticals within publishing is kind of like, I mean, I guess like all the shit.
It's all gone.
I'm like, you'd think this thing would be doing well. And I'm like, I don't actually even know what
it's all well would gone. Be.
But like Thrasher, like, I mean, I remember when Jake Phelps died, like what's happening now?
Thrasher's the funniest magazine in the world because it's the only one where the editor-in-chief shoots every cover photo. Not every cover photo, but Michael Burnett took over for Jake Phelps as editor, and he had been there forever and is, from what I've seen, pretty great at doing his job. But they don't run like a Condé magazine or like any other magazine. There are like, you know, 6 people on staff and they do all of the writing and the things. And there's not much, like, there aren't really many profiles or features. There's interviews, But yeah. I think that's as far as skate media publishing goes. I mean, there's a couple in Europe, a couple skate magazines in Europe, and there's a couple like big time zines that publish every month and have good interviews and great photos and stuff. But I think forever skateboarding has always been about the photos and the videos. And so it's fun when you can sneak in some written word, but the skaters aren't often reading it. And so then you're doing it for lay people. And so it's fun to get it in the Times or wherever they've been able to publish, GQ or Esquire, or wherever you can do a fun skater profile. In the same way that I think about the bowling one, where it's like, okay, we can sneak this into the larger culture at large.
Is there like a bowling blogging scene out there?
Yeah, there's a couple podcasts. This is the first time I have been on podcasts is since this article dropped, and the couple bowling podcasts both invited me on. Yeah, people, I mean, it's just like anything else. These bowling ball companies release 4 new bowling balls every month that all do different things and that they're selling to a huge consumer base who all watches YouTube reviews of the pros testing them out. And like, it's the same as your golf or your tennis or skateboarding or any of these things where we have found a large parasocial and e-commerce niche for hobbies.
It's striking in the story that even like this guy who's the Patrick Mahomes of bowling is like still pretty much like working in the warehouse of the like bowling supply company and has these very close relationships with the companies who are producing it. It's like it's as if the people who like made the football, the quarterbacks were pulling shifts working for them. Like,
yes, truly.
Well, actually, it sort of leads a question for me about like, you know, even within the media coverage, like you've covered the weed industry. And I know you do like some like consulting, like brand stuff within there. What's it like working in an environment where like the players, the people covering it, and the brands are all kind of like pretty closely tied together?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think weed is hard because you get to so many, I guess it's legal barriers, because things are changing so fast. And so much of the good coverage becomes about the legalization changes and how things are happening politically and how, you know, like so much of the Amanda Chicago Lewis stuff, who has produced the best long form articles about cannabis for the past 10 years, is about all these shady goings on between these corporate guys and these fucking bankers and random people who are trying to hijack weed from the people.
Yep.
And that's never really concerned me because I'm focused on weed and people who like weed and people who smoke weed.
Right.
And so the bankers and the suits have never, I understand and I dislike them and I do like love reading those stories and it's so hard, but I've never felt heavy conflict that way because so much of what I like covering and what I like showing people about cannabis is just the culture and the people. And obviously, I think those things intersect a lot and it will be harder and harder as more bad money comes into cannabis. But I've been able to kind of separate the like brand copywriting I do and the writing I do just because I'm not really an investigative journalist in that way, in that I'm looking for these connections between things in my writing.
This is something that came up with like people who like cover technology on the show too, where it's like, there's a drift towards everything ultimately becomes a business and then a business and politics story as it becomes large enough to command true business money. And when there's true business money, politics is always going to be a part of the control of that true money. Like all stories sort of roll downhill to business and politics.
Yes. And I'm not very good at that. And so I know where my limit is at that is that like, I'm not going to be the guy uncovering the shady money behind weed, but I will tell you about the guy who's growing the best weed and is the coolest guy because he does X, Y, and Z.
You're part of a writing family. I did not realize this until I researched this. I was like, he really retweets Malcolm Harris a lot. And then I was like, oh, and they have the same name. Oh, they're brothers.
That's my older brother.
Malcolm Harris, the author of Palo Alto, one of the books that was on my list of books to read to do an interview for the show. But it's so much easier if I just have to read an article. Sorry, Malcolm.
He's got a lot of those good ones, too.
He's got a lot of those good ones, too. Did you guys come from like a literary writing family? How did you both end up doing this?
I mean, we certainly had lots of books around the house, which they will all tell you I was very bad at reading while he was very good at reading.
Great. I'm enjoying this older brother, younger brother politics jumping in right away.
Now I get to gloat because I could be on the show first before him. Now you have to invite him on.
Absolutely. It's only fair to let him respond to these albums.
No, I mean, our dad was a lawyer and our mom was around the house most, but worked in like museum docentry and was always around doing art stuff. And so I guess just a well-read house more than like a writerly house. But no, I mean, we both did the high school newspaper, which was a very prestigious high school newspaper at a public school in Palo Alto, California. He was an editor. I was not. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was like so much as a writerly family. He certainly started a writing career directly after college, and I kind of still worked bartending jobs and worked retail and wrote aggregated news, which he would never do, and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Where it was like he was certainly a more professional writer than I was.
Where were you writing aggregated news?
So I was at First We Feast, the complex food vertical, for a couple years in 2013, 14, 15-ish era. And then they pivoted to video.
As one does.
Actually, they were the most successful pivot to video of anyone. And that Hot Wings show still haunts me because I got laid off for them to create that. And they have done fucking spectacularly with it. And so then there was no writing at that site anymore.
What would you say to someone who kind of wanted to pursue like a path of sort of following your interests and just like writing about the shit that you're into rather than maybe exactly what like an editor is asking for?
Well, yeah, it's like find another job, which is what, I mean, that's how I do the weed copywriting stuff, is because it's a job that actually pays me to write words and it's fun and I like doing it because it's a lot of writing about weed in the same way I would just as a brand's perspective as opposed to a writer's perspective. But I'm still talking about fun products and weed stuff that I like. But yeah, I've never been able to really sustain myself as a journalist money-wise. So I think it's hard. And when I was, it was because I was doing aggregated news with the odd feature here and there. And it was still fun. You know, I thought that I did aggregated news pretty well, but you're still writing about Chipotle lawsuits. But yeah, so I did weed news for a while at Snoop Dogg's Mary Jane website for a few years. And I did, you know, skateboard videos with a couple with Jenkum Skateboard Magazine. And I wrote some features at Vice and at Complex about sneakers and skateboarding. And yeah, I feel like knowing people, I feel like that was always the magic trick to writing, was figuring out that people who are editors at these sites are also just people who skateboard and hang out.
Yeah.
And so it's like, as long as you know the person and it's not like you're sending it to the ivory tower, you're just sending it to a person who knows who you are, it becomes a lot easier. And that is not like an easy way to get into writing. But also, if you like are out in the world doing cool stuff, you meet cool people, some of whom are editors at magazines or websites. And that's kind of how it always worked out for me.
I feel like we often have like kind of like older writers out here who are like, you know, have been doing this for 20 years. But like when you're starting off and you're at that first like pitch, are you like, hey, I know you know me as a skater, but like, do you know I also write stuff? Could I pitch you that? Like, how do you bridge that sort of gap between?
The first story I ever wrote was really lucky because so I had a pitch about Wrap Snacks potato chips.
I remember Wrap Snacks.
And Wrap Snacks were owned by Lil Romeo. I think they still might be owned in part by Lil Romeo. But they had like, there was never any marketing. It didn't really exist. But if you went to the corner stores in Philly where I went to college, you could still buy Wrap Snacks all the time. but in flavors still with like young Jock on the cover, despite him not having a song out in the past 6 years.
You got to move those, whether they're expired or not.
They were. You look at the bag. They were freshly made. Yeah, maybe the bags were old. But so I was, you know, I don't know if I had even written any full things, but my brother had convinced me to move up to New York after college. And so I was living in Brooklyn. And I was like, you know, it was 2014, 13. I was like, that sounds like a fun story that Vice might be interested in. And my brother was like, yeah, I know a guy at Vice. Here's his email. Send him a pitch. Write a pitch. And so I wrote a pitch. And the guy at Vice was like, no, thanks. We did like a listicle about Rap Snacks 3 years ago. And I clicked on it. It was like just five photos of bags of potato chips. And I was like, no. I'm talking about like looking at where these come from and who, like how they still exist and what that means for like the urban potato chip market, which seems different than the potato chip market in 7-Eleven and things like that. And he wasn't really hearing it and didn't kind of understand what I was saying. And then I just found the email of Drew Millard, who's still a friend, who was working at Noisy at the time, which was at Vice, but like a different editorial structure. I was like, it's owned by Lil Romeo, so it's a music story. And so I just sent him the pitch and he was like, oh, that sounds amazing. Hell yeah. Let's do it. Have you written anything before? I was like, you know, I was on the high school newspaper. But no, not really. Like, I think I might have sent him like a music review I had done in high school of like a 50 Cent album, I think. But he liked the pitch and the pitch was well written. And it was, you know, 200 words about what the thing was and what it was going to be. And he was like, yeah, let's go with it. Sure. It's for the internet. It's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it felt like at least back then, editors maybe had a little more leeway. But then that kind of led to the first We Feast opportunity. And so then they were like, you know how to write about food, do our news stuff and maybe pitch us features, which they never wanted to do.
Yeah, there's a degree to which, I mean, like, it's all sad, but like, there's one level which like there's less ways to make like a full-time living and there's like less publishing and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of losses there. But in some ways, the loss that feels the saddest to me is that there's just less places to just publish your first thing. Like,
yep,
there were places like The All and Noisy that people who were going to go on to do awesome shit, that was the first like email they sent and they took chances on people. And right. I just kind of wonder what the like sort of ripple effects, you know, in a decade later are. Is there just being less places for 22-year-olds to say, hey, I've got one clipping of a 50 Cent album review. Would you be interested? And I think that's right. Equally important to developing, you know, writers in the long run.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly hard. And now Twitter sucks. It's like that was where, you know, talking about skateboarding on Twitter is where I met a lot of the dudes who edit these things. And you realize that a lot of the 35-year-olds who don't skateboard as much, but still keep up with it and like to talk about skateboarding, got cool jobs in media. And yeah, those connections, if you can't make them and if they don't exist in the same way, it's so hard to find any way into anything.
Well, on that vaguely depressing note, thank you very much for this interview, Zach. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me, Aaron.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Gabriella Saldivia for editing this episode. Thanks to Susan Peterson for doing the show notes. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to everyone over at Vox. We'll be back with a brand new show next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.